The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast July 23rd, 2024. The opinions on this broadcast are those of the host and guest only, and not those of KZSM or its parent corporation, SMTX CRA. Every day, every day. Good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked on KZSM.org, your true community radio station, where today the book under discussion is Healthcare, Confessions of a Hospital Spin Doctor. And we have in the studio the hospital spin doctor himself, Clay DeStefano. You want to say hi?
Hi, everyone.
Okay. Clay, you might know Clay already as the executive director of the Price Center, or maybe as an artist, particularly in ceramics, I think, right?
Yeah.
But before that, he was director of public relations, marketing, and foundation at Central Texas Medical Center, which is now Christus Santa Rosa, San Marcos, if you're like me, you keep forgetting. Director of foundation, is that a fancy word for fundraising?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
That's what
Which,
I thought.
Which, by the way, I didn't even know I had that job when I was hired for the other jobs. That was added when I got here.
Oh, okay. go out and get us some foundation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Go find some money.
And before that, he had a long, successful career doing public relations, particularly for hospitals and other medical organizations. He's given since this book, he's given a TED Talk and some other presentations on aging, wellness, and medicine. Is there anything you'd like me to add about you?
You know, really, that sounds pretty good. I think that's pretty close to, I'm a dad. I've got three kids. I'm a grandfather. My wife and I just celebrated our 43rd wedding anniversary. So,
all right.
I'm an uncle. I'm a brother. Oh. All those things.
Congratulations on all those,
thanks.
Fronts.
Thanks.
All right. I usually try to summarize the book.
Sure.
And I guess I would say it's both a memoir and an examination of our flawed healthcare system. And so it's kind of chronological through your life in these various positions that you held.
Right.
And it draws on everything you learned about the healthcare industry as a public relations officer. And it's pretty critical overall of the healthcare industry. Not to say that everybody in it is terrible, but somehow that particular view was maybe not the most salutary one. Do you want to explain how you came to write the book?
Well, I would say sure. I would say that initially, in some ways, I started writing the book the very first day I stepped into the healthcare world. I was making mental notes the whole time because it was so foreign to me and in some ways shocking to me that it just kept making impressions.
What were you doing? I realized I was curious and never asked you this. What did you do before that? And what was your major, if you had a major?
Well, I dropped out of school. I was an art and English major. I did not finish. So I always was working with words and pictures and, you know, writing in some capacity because I was in the newspaper business, so I did some writing. I did some editing. I was in the backside. I did all the production stuff. Mm-hmm. And my parents owned a printing company, so we did typesetting and advertising. You know, it all kind of just spilled out of words and pictures, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
So my first experience was at a newspaper, and then I was hired by a hospital in Florida, and I worked for them for a year. And then I was hired away by the physician group that they were aligned with after that first year and went to work.
But you were telling me about how it was kind of a shock to you.
It was I'd never worked in a system, number one. I'd worked in small businesses, private companies, you know, even the newspaper business. The newspapers I worked with were small community newspapers. They weren't Gannett or, you know, so the whole corporate environment was foreign to me and shocking to me. And the hierarchy, if you will, was the shocking part. For example, my very first day, a gentleman got on the elevator and introduced himself. Hi, I'm Bob. And I said, hi, Bob, it's nice to meet you. I'm Clay. And then he stepped off, and my boss immediately turned to me and said, don't ever address a physician by his first name.
Oh.
And I said, oh, well, he introduced himself by his first name. I assumed You know, so there were just so many faux pas from day one, because it's such an interesting culture that I was not familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come to write the book?
Well, thanks for bringing me back to that.
That's okay.
So after all was said and done, it was really kind of the last straw for me. My wife had been quite ill and had been ill for a couple of years, and we were really hitting a wall, not getting anywhere, using the healthcare system, doing all the things that I was kind of skeptical of, to be honest with you, in some ways, all along, and the experience with my wife's illness kind of validated all that for me. So ultimately, when it was all said and done, I had lost my position. I'd been fired from CTMC. My wife was quite ill, and I felt it was time to sort of cleanse my soul and clarify what really is going on in the healthcare world. Mm-hmm. Because my job was to shine a spotlight on the good.
Right.
On, you know, talk about what works, talk about the great stuff, talk about the mission, talk about community involvement, whatever it might be, even the latest and greatest medical breakthrough, which I was fortunate enough to be a part of many times, really. So it was easy to focus on good stuff. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I never, you know, professionally never talked about all the bad stuff, but on a personal level, I felt the need to say it, to make people aware of what the game really is, how it really works. So they're using healthcare with their eyes wide open.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel better after you wrote it?
I really did.
Yeah.
I didn't care if it got published, to be honest with you. At that point in time, it was, you know, it was getting it all out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pleased with the fact that it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it made sense and all that. So it was quite rewarding.
It's infinitely readable.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
And thought-provoking. So
cool.
And well, you talk quite a bit about solutions and what people should do, and we'll pick up more of that at the end. But even now. You talk about, one question that kind of arises when one reads this is, okay, at what point do you think a person should seek professional health care? Because you point out that in some cases, natural remedies work better than traditional medicine. That turned out to be the case with your wife's illness, for example. There are a lot of side effects with traditional medicine. I mean, where, you know, if somebody said to you, well, I don't know, how do I decide whether to see the doctor or whether to try to do something else? What would you say?
Well, I mean, obviously there are alarm bells that go off, and things like heart attacks, things that, you know, people lose consciousness, injuries, things like that. Obviously, seek immediate health care, you know. I'm talking about stuff that might just be a cold, or it might just be a sprain, or it might just be a pulled muscle, or it might just be a small bout of a stomach flu or something like that. I think people are much too quick to run to the doctor. And in that sense, I think that you should let things run their course and make sure that you need to see a doctor. Because, by the way, the doctor's not going to say, no, you can't see me. The doctor is in the business of seeing you. And so they're going to see you and likely treat you. And that's another issue, because, you know, maybe you need that medication, maybe you don't.
Yeah, I have known doctors to say, you know, there's nothing you can do, it'll go away, you know.
Good, congratulations. I mean, that's becoming farther and farther and fewer between those kinds
really?
Of encounters. It really is.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And partly because, again, the system is in place to, you know, code, figure out what are you in for, how do we treat it, what do we get paid for, what are we going to do, and send you on your merry way. And generally with a prescription, because that's what you went in requesting, and very often you leave with that.
You talk about your experience at a world-famous clinic, which you don't name, but it's pretty obvious, when your wife was ill, and you receive wonderful care and attention while you are actually present there. But after you leave, you don't get the test results that you're expecting. Instead, you get bills, and you can't communicate, and it's, you know, and you wind up deciding that, as you write here. I think you probably could tell from the notes that I like to read from the book, so
I'm glad.
People have an idea. By then, it seemed painfully obvious that even the leading healthcare facility in the country is only focused on you when you are present and paying for the appointments, tests, and procedures that they so effectively and efficiently arrange in your presence. I felt that there were no more immediate money to be made off my wife's care. Their white glove service had deteriorated to the same dysfunctional series of miscommunications, ball dropping, and finger pointing as it does for every other health provider in America today. I had mistaken their culture of providing excellence in care services with caring. Would you care to expand on that?
Well, I think that as I said in the book, I think they were the best at doing it and mm-hmm. making you feel comfortable. And I would liken it to Disney World, if you will. You are entertained, you are engaged, there is world-class art, there's world-class music, and there are world-class physicians there. And from the beginning to the end, as the caregiver and the escort for the patient, I was fully cared for, fully engaged, and felt good about the experience from that perspective. But again, the outcome was the same. We did not get an answer. We never got an answer, really. This is what we think it is, but there was never any definitive test that showed with certainty that that's what it was. So that's what they were treating, because that's what they, that being vasculitis. Vasculitis is what it's called in the book, and that's what they thought it was. So I just felt like, here's the thing with that, Priscilla. My whole career, part of my job was creating this perfect, what we called guest relations, so this hotel-like experience for the consumer, so that they have a high-quality healthcare experience and that they will rate us well, so that we are highly rated, we get better mm-hmm. ratings for insurance purposes, we can claim that we're, you know, the best hospital in wherever we are, and so it's all part of that process of collecting and pleasing patients. So you collect the data that you need to tell the story that you need to tell.
Yeah, I understand that. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to skip to a question that I wanted to ask you. Since you described so well what your job is as a public relations person for the hospital,
sure.
Do you think, and then I'll follow up with another question about this, do you think that shapes your attitude? In other words, because it was your job to make everything look good,
yeah.
The bad things or the inadequacies, the failures, and every institution and every person will have some failures,
of course.
Really stood out to you, and kind of, you know, that sharp contrast sounds like it wore on your nerves.
Oh, no question. Because I was, as you said, I was the public information officer. I was the guy that stood in front of the microphone and answered the question, no matter what. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, had to be able to be truthful. Mm-hmm. I had to be able to speak truth. I mean, that's a bugaboo with me. I'm an honest person to a fault. And I hold, you know, my employers, my colleagues, my family, my friends to that same standard, unfortunately. And so I was always aware of, you know, what could happen or what did happen and how I would have to reposition it. So, yeah, mm-hmm. no question. I was looking at it through a critical eye, a trained eye. But eventually, you know, when it became personal, as with my wife's care, then I couldn't deny it any longer. You know, I always knew and saw and had my suspicions and felt, geez, this should work better. But it really wasn't until I was inside of it with my father, inside of it with my wife, inside of it with my mother's care at different times that I really saw, again, mm-hmm. the failures, you know, in real time from both sides of the system.
Yeah, and you talked in talking about going to the famous clinic of this contrast between how it felt when you were there and how it felt when you left. And couldn't that be possibly a difference between actual care providers and administrators, and that the actual care providers did care about you, but then once you had left, the responsibility for getting out information and for providing it and for doing all that went to administrators who didn't know you and were just doing their job and didn't care.
Yeah, I think that's very valid, and I think that's part of the challenge of the current model, is that you might have a wonderful one-on-one experience with the provider, And I think that, again, it's, we back in the day we called it high tech and high touch. And so the trick was you had to keep your high touch while you became high tech. And I think, unfortunately, the industry's become more and more tech and less touch. And as a result of that, that's the disparity that you're describing, the technical side, the administrative side, the back office side. That's where it gets hard and messy and sometimes ugly and rude even. But at the care level, in many cases, and certainly in the case of this institution, it was as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you brought up, because we were talking about that before the program started, about just the general, the change from touch to tech.
Exactly.
My beloved doctor retired and was replaced by another physician whom I like, but it's a totally different experience.
Yeah.
But is that, I was getting onto the question about you're saying that doctors are motivated by money. By and large, doctors, just like insurance companies, big pharma and hospitals make decisions based on the economic impact to their business. I mean, do you really think all the use of tech in medicine is strictly a matter of money and is strictly expeditious, or you don't think that people actually think, well, it works better? I mean, you know, I remember the first time my now retired doctor came in to the examining room holding a laptop,
right.
And said, I'm getting used to this thing. I think it's helpful. You know, I can keep track of everything.
He was
happy with it.
Yeah. So he was willing to learn. He was willing to grow and change. Surprisingly, when that requirement, which was, by the way, brought on by the government, when physicians had to sign their own orders and do their own data entry, order prescriptions, order tests, they all had to start to use computers. And it was shocking how many of them hadn't used a computer yet, Priscilla. Mm-hmm. And this was, I'm talking the 2000s, okay? And so the challenge is that many of them get caught or stuck, if you will, in this routine. They know what they know. They treat the way they treat. And there's no reason or requirement to make them do it differently. Mm-hmm. So they stay doing it until technology or an employer comes in, buys out their group, or they suddenly become a corporate employee, then they have to succumb to the process, like the rest of us.
So, but I guess my question was, you know, you were kind of implying that the move to tech was largely economically motivated, and I was trying to suggest that maybe not so much.
I think the potential for good is there, but I think the reason that it was happening, again, it's all about capturing. If you think of the healthcare industry and you realize that it's a business and it's all about the money, who pays, how much you get paid, and where does it all go, then they have to document everything. So the technology is really all about documentation, which used to all be hand done. Mm-hmm. The chart, you know, the famous chart.
Yeah.
Well, now we all have electronic charts, which was a big deal when it went down in the beginning. Now everybody has, you know, electronic medical records, and these things can happen, you know, in vapor, and you can send information, all that. That used to be such a clunky system. So, yeah, there's huge improvements that have come about through technological changes. But the driver of it is to make sure that the hospital's not losing money, that the insurer's not paying for things that they don't pay for, that, you know, that the prescriptions are things that we cover versus writing prescriptions that we don't cover, things like that. They're all safeguards and checks to make sure that you're staying within the lane.
Okay. Interesting way of putting it. You really do say that...
Let me clarify. The question of doctors being driven by money.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they're all a bunch of greedy, you know, monsters out there. What I'm saying is the system, the current system that they work within, the playing field. This is the game. And so if you're going to make money and stay in the game and cover your expenses and your malpractice insurance, or you're going to cover your staff expenses, you're going to keep up with technology, you're going to keep up with trainings, then, yeah, you have to be playing the game a certain way, which means you're chasing the dollar, and that's just the reality of the business. It doesn't mean they're still not caregivers. It doesn't mean they don't care about, you know, the healthcare industry or their particular specialty. But if they're in it for any length of time, they're going to be in the money game, because it is a money game.
Yeah. And does the money game, as you put it, you suggest that the money game extends ordering tests and ordering procedures, because you talk about, you know.
Sure, because many times they own that establishment. Mm-hmm. Through partnership, through, you know, contractual relationship. And here's where we're seeing much more of that today, and that is in the cosmetic surgery industry, the mm-hmm. weight loss industry, all these freestanding entities which are independently owned, many times by physician group practices and such. That's where they really stand to make money, because in many cases, they're not having to deal with the insurance industry. It's cash. It's, you know, fee mm-hmm. for service. People are willing to pay out of their pocket for all these kinds of things that don't fall under the same, you know, restrictions and requirements that traditional medical care does.
Yeah. You do say also, and you're already kind of touching on this, that doctors have in some ways difficult working conditions.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Imagine trying to run a profitable business that is based on providing care to a certain number of patients using protocols and systems that are constantly changing and very often designed by others who don't practice in the field. In other words, the corporate entity that's trying, huge debt, little or no control, not the game you thought it was, and constantly changing rules, regulations, and reimbursement rates.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. I think it's a very tough game. Really. And then imagine that's the person that you're putting your life's hand, you know, you're putting your life in their hands. You're expecting them to care about you, care for you, and fix you when they have all that on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm saying, is we need to be aware as consumers of healthcare, the game that we're in as well.
Yeah. And on that note, we are up on our first break.
Wow, how about that?
Air Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock. Till 10 o'clock, you got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Now on exhibition, I Pray You Survive, Writing on the Edge. The Whitliff explores how our best writers have personally confronted life or death situations, from war to pandemics, race riots, and murder, to create their groundbreaking work. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Welcome back to Bookmark, where we are talking with Clay DiStefano about his book, Health Scare, Confessions of a Hospital Spin Doctor. How did you come up with that title?
You know, it's funny. It seemed to write itself. I don't know if people, you know, some people go, spin doctor, what is that? You know, it's an older term, but, mm-hmm. but a spin doctor is putting a positive spin on things.
Yeah.
And back in the day, they were, you know, particularly like in politics, there were a lot of spin doctors. Mm-hmm. So it just made sense, I mean, because obviously the doctor concept, and people often ask me if I was a doctor walking down the halls, and so it just seemed to make sense. But really, it was more about this...
You never said, no, I'm a spin doctor, huh?
I never said that. I would often say, no, I'm not a doctor at all, but that wouldn't stop them from telling me about their healthcare issues and wanting answers just the same.
Well, yeah. you talk about, and this is, and I guess we should mention that this book is like 9 years old, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I will ask you as we go along if you think some things have changed.
Of course.
But one thing you talk about is the, in 2006, the hospital industry kicked off a national patient safety industry initiative called 100,000 Lives. But apparently preventable medical errors were killing 100,000 Americans each year. And then in 2014, there was a Journal of Patient Safety did a study on medical errors are the third leading cause of death in the United States. Is that I was shocked by that.
I know.
Did that really happen? Is it? although it explains why when I had the lumpectomy, the surgeon came in and actually wrote on my body.
Exactly.
To make sure that, yeah. I guess. You know.
And that goes back to your question earlier about technology. I mean, technology is part of that safety net, part of catching things, because it'll ask, it'll check you on, mm-hmm. you know, what you're entering. That doesn't make sense. Are you sure you meant to do that, in so many words? So yeah, but unfortunately, it's still, you know, I haven't checked the stats recently. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to take a look, but I think I would not be at all surprised to see if it's at least constant, if not continuing to go up.
How do you think all that stuff tends to happen, or do you have an idea?
I do have an idea. I mean, I saw some of it happen firsthand. Human error is obviously the first part of it. There's exhaustion, there's confusion, there's miscommunication. There's lots of reasons that things happen, but very often it's because, again, we're looking at the technology, we're looking at the machine, we're looking, you know, healthcare providers make very quick assessments. You know, they walk in a room and they go, okay, here's an old person. They're probably even maybe partly senile. I mean, who knows what? So they're deaf. And they kind of size you up and go, they kind of dismiss you. And so they're not watching the same way. They're watching those vital signs that, again, they're following the computer, they're following the basics, but they're not really connecting with you. And so I think a lot of times they mishear, they misinterpret, they misread. But certainly, I think there's a lot of bias in the medical system. We certainly see that in terms of certain outcomes with certain populations. People of color have much worse outcomes in healthcare than white people. Mm-hmm. And undeniably so. Our maternal fetal medicine numbers in the United States are abysmal. They're as bad as, you know, developing countries.
I know,
way at the bottom of the list. Priscilla, it's 2024.
And you think that's misogyny, sexism. You know,
sexism,
people don't care
racism,
about women.
It's also inherent in the system because it's baked in. It's just like we talked about baked in racism in the culture. You know, you're hearing that today. It's very much the same in healthcare because healthcare providers are given godlike status.
Yeah.
You do not question them. You do not cross them. You do not, you know, in any way, shape, or form get in their way because they can hurt you mm-hmm. in the business. Mm-hmm. If you're a nurse, if you're a tech, if you're a provider, if you're a PR writer. These guys have a lot of power, mm-hmm. and so people are afraid to cross them and question them.
You mean doctors have a lot of power?
Yes.
Okay. You do talk about that. You say doctors rule. They are treated as a special class that is not required to play by the same set of rules the rest of us do. And the protection, lack of accountability, and rewarding of bad behaviors is costing people their well-being and, in some cases, their lives.
Indeed. Mm.
Well, I do recall reading stories occasionally that, oh, you know, this doctor has been committing some sort of egregious, you know, abuse for years and years, and it finally comes out,
right.
You know, but as, you know, when it gets really bad and is publicized, and then it turns out, oh, this has been going on for, you know,
well,
you see that.
And I would say that's because on some level, everybody lives in a glass house. And so I refer to the thin white line in the book, but no one wants to, you know, report a colleague for something that they may or may not be guilty of themselves or down the road might be responsible for. So there's this culture of protection.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not self-police. No mm-hmm. industry self-polices. And to think that any industry does is just foolish. And so there's really no one watching out for you. There just has to be such a bad outcome that it reaches your point, that it comes to the public awareness, and then something happens after that.
But wouldn't you think people would be afraid of being sued for malpractice?
Well, that's part of the reason they don't tell anyone. They don't want
mm-hmm.
to deal with and the hospital doesn't want the bad PR. I mean, you know, I dealt with some very highly trained, really special physicians. I mean, I worked with one of the doctors that was training on the Jarvik 7 artificial mm-hmm. heart program when I first started in the industry. And, you know, people that were beta testing the cochlear implants, which, you know, now are very just part of modern day it's a very normal thing now to have a cochlear implant. At the time, this was, you know, cutting edge stuff. So very often, one of our doctors that I was involved with was a pioneer in keyhole heart surgery at the time. Mm-hmm. Nobody else was doing this non-invasive or less invasive procedure. So I worked with guys that were big and successful, and the institution had a lot of money wrapped up in them and made them poster children for the institution. And part of my job was to interview them, promote them, take pictures, advertise them, build a brand around them. Mm-hmm. And so that goes back to, you know, their power is disproportionate, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do say that we give doctors way too much power.
And the consumer does too. The consumer goes, okay, fix me. Mm-hmm. Hey, you got a white coat, you got a stethoscope, you can fix me.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're people who have learned a lot about this particular thing and they try to employ it as best they can.
Of course.
They're just, and yes, they went to medical school, so they know more about it than you do, but it's just it's a process. And you think most people don't realize that?
I do think, unfortunately, most people don't realize that these guys are still learning. They are still developing skills and techniques.
The reason that both my husband and I had the physician that we had for many, many years until he retired was that when my husband consulted him first, and he had a something that he thought was a side effect of a medication he was taking, and he asked about it, and the doctor said, "Well, I don't know about that, but I'll look it up," you know. And he said, "Okay, that's the guy you want. That's our doctor.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Because of course they have to look it up. I mean, they can't know everything. I mean, you make the point. You know, doctors are people. They're not superhuman. Doctors are not gods. They're not all knowing. They're not all good guys. They're not all good at their craft. Like all of us, they make mistakes. Many make bad choices. You know.
Yeah, they're human.
Yeah.
And so all I'm saying is, again, I'm not trying to say they're all bad people. They're monsters. What I'm saying is they're human, just like you and me. And we have seen a decline in customer service, if you will, human interaction through the years. If you go to, you know, any retail establishment now, try to get just a pleasant interaction with somebody at the counter. Well, guess what? These guys are, you know, living in the same world you are, and they're dealing with life and death many times. So it's even harder to stay engaged and interested and focused on you, because all the same distractions that are affecting you. And now there's cell phones and all these other things that they're dealing with. And you know, I think it's only gotten harder. I really, really do. And I feel like it's incumbent upon all of us as users of healthcare to understand how healthcare works and only use it when we need to and use it effectively and not abuse it.
What do you think would help people realize that, you know, look upon doctors as, you know, not to completely reject them or always mistrust them, but just to be aware of, you know, that they are fallible, that they are drawing on what they know as best they can and subject to distractions, as you just described.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an individual call, I would say, Priscilla. I mean, I can tell you that in the last 2 years, I've had two physical exams and two different providers. And I based my experience on the few minutes I had interacting with them on a human level, actually talking and them asking me questions and following up, you know, personal questions about me and then following up on my personal answers that weren't health related. In other words, they were building a relationship with me, and I felt good about that.
Yeah.
Because I think if you can't, that's your basis for everything. That's your starting point. If you don't stop to get a better understanding of who this person is, then how do you care for them? You know, where do you go from there, in other words?
Yeah, I think my doctor now, the doctor who has replaced the doctor who retired, is certainly does that. And that brings me to something that, you know, we're getting to that a lot of people say is, you know, well, doctors are terrible. You can't rely on any of them except for my doctor. Which I think people do tend to say.
I think so. You know, it's like children or anything. I mean, we don't tend to see it in our own, right? But I think that in terms of where we are in healthcare today, I just don't think we're going in the right direction. And I think that people, while they may, again, have a good relationship with their physician, I don't think that they should be putting all of their faith and confidence in the physician. They have to listen to their own bodies. They have to be accountable for their own actions, their own health on some level. That's really where I come from with all of it, is being accountable.
Something just occurred to me that I didn't put in the notes, but when I try to be accountable for my own health, I go to the internet and I, with some, you know, with some skepticism.
Of course.
You know, sure. And that's because my both past and present physician send you to WebMD, so I figure if the physician actually sent you to that website,
yes,
it must be reliable. But what do you think of, you know, consulting the internet altogether as a practice for a part of being in control of one's own health?
I think, like anything else, it's a risk, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you're going to find a lot of information. You might find good, helpful information. You might find bogus information. I think there are credible sources. WebMD is certainly one that's been well recognized. But I'll tell you, early on, as the internet was being born, when I was in the industry, doctors did not want their patients going online, did not want their patients doing any research. They would just say, oh, now, you know, the doctor said, don't do that. He's going to take care of you. And they would treat them like little children. I heard and saw this on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And some people, okay, the doctor said, don't do it, so I'm not going to do it. Again, mm-hmm. information is power. So I think becoming informed is where it begins. How you choose to use it, what you choose to do with it, including going back to the doctor with some information, is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
I don't think you should, you know, you should necessarily treat yourself in every circumstance, but I think that there is a lot of information out there, and there are certainly other methodologies that aren't recognized in the American industry now. Mm-hmm. Certainly a lot of Eastern medical practices, you talked about alternative therapies already briefly, things like that, diet, exercise. There's so much that factors into one's health that aren't a part of the daily dialogue. No one, you know, again, the last two physicals, I've had two now in the last 2 years, and no one asked me about my diet or asked, you know, they didn't ask me about my lifestyle much. You know, my numbers were good, so... Okay, mm-hmm. So you're fine, you're healthy, you're well.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to the doctor when I was 40, and he walked in and he shook my hand and said, hello, young man, you're a very healthy person. And I said, well, how do you know? I mean, I'm literally fully clothed, all you've done is shake my hand. I can tell by looking at you, he said. And that was the first of my big blows, was like, wait a minute, at 40, aren't I supposed to have all these tests, and aren't these things supposed to happen? And in a quick visual, no, you're fine, you don't need anything.
That's sort of funny.
It is.
Do you think, I mean, you're describing a kind of patronizing attitude on the part of some doctors. Do you think that's changing now, particularly, and a lot more women are in the medical field? I think I read somewhere that more medical students are women now than men.
Right.
Do you think that's going to make much of a difference?
I hope so. What I will say is, thus far, my experience with women in the industry, as they rose up the ranks, mm-hmm. and as they took management positions and they took leadership positions, the ones that survived acted like men.
Yeah.
And played the same game. And so, you know, again, when you're talking about changing a culture, it takes a long time to change culture. And I'm not sure that the women in these roles will survive long enough to mm-hmm. change the culture if they don't play within the current culture,
mm-hmm.
much like politics, much like everything else.
Yeah.
So we have to run on two tracks, it
And
seems.
So far as you know, there hasn't been much change in the 9 years since you wrote the book. I mean, I realize you don't monitor the healthcare system as, you know, you're not part
in,
of it.
In what
you
sense,
were.
Though? But I'm not
well, really... any kind of positive change, you know.
I do think that... you know, again, I think the technology changes and the advancements that are being made. AI is very exciting. Everyone's screaming about AI, but the reality is in healthcare, it's very, very exciting. The things that can be done through technology are changing healthcare dramatically and changing the way we're, again, the way we're seen, the way we're provided for. I talk about handheld healthcare 9 years ago, again, using your phone for many things. Well, mm-hmm. you know, now we're finding that a lot of those things are available to you mm-hmm. through your phone. But again, there's a limit to what they can do, but they're a good monitor. They're a good check and balance For helping you.
I guess
get
what
there.
I was trying to ask, I realized that the question was a little vague, was do you think there have been any sort of attitudinal changes as, you know, I mean, when you walk into a hospital and you start seeing doctors, they're a lot more diverse than they used to be. You know, you're going to see women, you're going to see people from other
sure.
backgrounds.
Sure.
And it's not just a middle-aged white guy, you know. That always kind of feels different to me. I mean, it feels more like these are
my people,
or at least people, you know,
yeah,
people
yeah.
I can relate to, and I do not have to feel intimidated by.
Right, right.
You know,
I think that's yes. I think potentially that's changing, but again, I think they're all working within a system that requires you to work a certain way to conform. Mm-hmm. Fill, you know, press the buttons, answer the thing, and get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to work within the system that they're working within, they're going to have to perform like everybody else. Now, will that leave room for them to be, you know, better caregivers, more empathetic? I think that's going to be a case-by-case basis. That comes
yeah.
down to the individual provider, as it currently did in my experience. I knew a lot of great providers, a lot of great people in healthcare. I had wonderful colleagues that worked with me in the industry through the years. But also, again, we were all required to stay within the parameters of, you know, the mm-hmm. company line.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right. Well, believe it or not, we are up on our next break.
Very good.
On Saturday, August the 3rd, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., the Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 3413 will hold a Save the San Marcos VFW Building fundraiser. They are asking for your support to come out and purchase a chicken and sausage plate for a $12 donation. Come out to the VFW located at 1701 Hunter Road on Saturday, August the 3rd.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections. Subscribe to our email list today and stay in the know about all the great events, exhibitions, and news happening at the finest collection of literary, photography, and music holdings in the Southwest. The Whitliff Collections is free and open to the public. We're located on the 7th floor of the Alkeck Library at Texas State University. For more information, please contact us at the Whitliff Collections. txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked on KZSM.org, your true community radio station, where we are talking with Clay DiStefano about his book, Healthcare, Confessions of a Hospital Spin Doctor, which he no longer is, but certainly was came to terms with as he by writing this book, I guess that's a way to put it.
Well said, yes.
Yeah. Something about, I mean, we're talking about doctors and attitudes, you know, what motivates them. You're suggesting that even the most conscientious and caring doctor is still under the pressure of a certain system to deliver in certain ways, you know, and that's
if they want to be paid,
yeah,
they have to perform.
Yeah. And one other thing about the performance, which I think I'll skip to, is the whole question of keeping patients alive. I mean, I realized that myself when I had an interaction with two different doctors about, and one of them wanted to do a test which might indicate that I needed chemotherapy. And the other one said, well, it wouldn't help you that much, and it would put you through chemotherapy, this discomfort, and it wouldn't. I did have the test, and it wasn't indicated, so I was fortunate in that way.
Spared that
but
decision.
Yes. I was really interested that, you know, here's a doctor who is that she was actually kind of thinking, okay, what's your experience going to be? What's
right.
What's your quality of life going to be?
Right.
And of course, I you know, and I realized that, but I. You know, you can't blame them. I mean, they have enough to think about just keeping you alive, let alone, you know, trying to, you know, take care of your quality of life.
Absolutely.
But I still, you know, wondered what kind of comments you had on that, or how that reflects in your experience.
A lot. You know, I think initially, my first few years, I didn't really see that side of it. And I didn't really recognize sort of the limits, what I felt should have been the limits of the system, I should say, mm-hmm. until I started working at the second system, which was a faith-based system, and it had a children's hospital within it. And so I saw quintuplets being born, which made, you know, national news and all that, and then saw all the effects of these, what these kids went through being so prematurely born and all of the difficulties that they faced. And we had all these, you know, services on site. We were children's medical services. And so, you know, all these people that received care with special needs and things like that. I began to wonder, you know, at what point do we stop intervening? You know, when is it too early to save a baby? Yeah. Right? Yeah. What is the outcome afterwards? The shark attack, you know,
that's
which I
really
write
hard.
About,
yeah, I want to describe the shark attack because maybe not everyone remembers
another
it.
Another example of, yeah. you know, holy cow, what are we doing here?
Yeah. This 8-year-old boy was attacked by a shark, this is in 2001, in shallow water in Florida. His arm was severed and his leg almost torn off. His uncle, incredibly enough, managed to pulled the shark to shore and retrieve his arm. His arm was reattached, and it was a huge, huge media thing, which you said you were involved in.
Yeah.
But great sensationalism. But what people wanted, you know, the media was fixated on the boy's arm and kept asking questions about it. One doctor tried to explain the full extent of his injuries, but it didn't fit their sensational story. The lead podiatrist intensivist on our team explained that the arm was the least of his troubles. He had damage to his kidneys, lung, and brain from having almost bled out.
Right.
I looked him up. He's still alive, but is in bedridden and fed with a tube.
Right. And so here it is, 20-plus years later now, and that young man's quality of life, his parents' quality of life, his siblings' quality of life. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I understand in the heat of the moment.
Yeah.
I understand the uncle and the aunt saving his life on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily understand the helicopter flying in and taking him to the hospital and doing 11 hours of surgery to keep him alive. Mm-hmm. That, and then to have him tank the next day. And that's why he ended up at our hospital, because we were a children's hospital. It wasn't our hospital that picked him off on the beach and reattached his arm. That was the local air ambulance. And so that was the beginning of, you know, questionable decisions.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
as he started to die, they called us because we were a children's hospital. So we were brought in to try and save him. But by the time he got to that hospital, our hospital, it had already been a 24-hour, 36-hour maybe story. And they were telling, you know, that hospital was saying that his eyes are open, he's awake, he's smiling, which of course was not true. He was in a coma.
Oh.
And so that began this false sense of this sensational story, this kid, you know, there was just so much that I was literally on the, you know, in front of the world. I was on the radio in London and Australia and Mexico City and you know, the national media was standing literally in front of me with a microphone, you know, wanting to hear more about this story. And the story was this kid's upstairs dying. But by the way, he's not the sickest kid in this hospital. In fact, compared to many of the children we're treating upstairs, he's in better shape. And that was another, like, what? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Why are you talking about them? You know?
It's the arm story and the shark story.
It was just so sensational that people couldn't let it go. But when it was all said and done, as much as proud as I was of our team and our ability to somehow make this thing work, and we created fundraisers, and we created, you know, this was very early in the system where we created links, and we just had a relatively new website, and I was trying to make it all about helping people, and if you want to donate to his care and do all these things, stop the sensationalism, talk really about this is the rest of this child's life and his family's life as well. So this isn't about, you know, this week. This is what we're dealing with. But again, they were gone. As soon as the story ended, they left. And that poor child, as you pointed out a moment ago, is still alive and still, you know, leading a very difficult life.
Yeah, those decisions are hard enough to make with an adult, like you talk about your father going into hospice, and
sure.
how that was
sure.
that was the best thing. And I've heard and known about that with other people, but with a child, I mean, how would you possibly decide?
I mean, I think we need to talk about quality of life in real terms, and I think hospice is a great example, Priscilla, because most providers don't order hospice until the week of death,
mm-hmm.
Maybe 2 weeks out. Oh, you're ready for hospice. Well, we see, maybe you don't know this, but hospice can be ordered 18 months out and can be renewed every 18 months. And the point of hospice is it's a different kind of care. It's a different mm-hmm. quality of care. It's a different kind of care. And it's about making people comfortable and helping them through what is ultimately a terminal illness.
Mm-hmm.
But they can live with a terminal illness for a number of years,
yeah.
right? And so there's a reluctance to refer people to hospice because people think it's a death sentence
yeah.
once you're on death. Because that's the way it looks. Because
mm-hmm.
that's the way people use it currently. But again, mm-hmm. it goes back to kind of perverse incentives in the system. If your whole existence is save the patient, do all you can't suddenly change gears and go, okay, it's time to stop trying,
mm-hmm.
right? And so part
to
of it is...
accept that this person is going
yeah,
to die.
Part of it is you're asking this person to make this... about-face decision about healthcare all of a sudden. Okay, I'm going to stop doing this. By the way, this patient who I make money off of, who, I see once a week for labs and all these things, that will all stop once I send them to hospice care.
Mm-hmm.
I'll lose my income stream.
Well...
Is that a major factor? Maybe, maybe not. But I'm just saying the system is built in such a way that it's
yeah,
not encouraging.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with you
choices.
About the system. I guess I tend to be a little more sanguine about... the individuals involved. I mean, you set up here, it's somewhere that you never met a doctor who didn't feel that he or she was best in their field.
Right.
Never?
Honestly, as I said a moment ago, because of my position, I was dealing with the guy doing the Jarvik 7 artificial mm-hmm. heart. I was doing the cochlear implants.
Well,
I
he
was
probably thinks he's the best
surgery.
In his field.
A lot of the people I profiled and wrote about and, dealt with were the best.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew it, and they carried themselves in that
mm-hmm.
manner.
Mm-hmm.
Have I ever met a physician who wasn't as confident? Certainly. But honestly, I mean, I remember one guy when we started a bariatric surgery program. He said, I can do surgery with a soup can lid. I don't need all this fancy, because we were buying all this equipment, and he
mm-hmm.
was, trying to impress on me that he doesn't need any equipment at all. He could do it with a lid from a soup
yeah,
can.
I've met doctors like that, actually.
I mean, sure, of course, there are doctors that probably are less confident. I didn't meet many of them.
Mm-hmm.
I always met the ones that felt like they were really
mm-hmm.
special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that their opinion, everything mattered more than mine.
Yeah. It is, we are overdue
Holy
for you.
Holy cow.
Yeah, yeah, you have, because you have a lot of advice and suggestions on the individual level. And I think maybe I'll get rid of this on the collective level. Because you said... you didn't think single payer could work. And when we were
right.
talking before the program, you sort of clarified that you thought it would need to be phased in, that it couldn't
exactly.
just
exactly.
be done overnight. But you do seem, I mean, it does seem to me very clear from your book and from my own experience that the profit motive does not belong in healthcare.
It is no business being in healthcare. It's created this Frankenstein model of, this, what is a social service, if you will, in many ways, but it's also paid for through government funding, but it's also through private industry. And then there's self-pay and all these things like we talked about with cosmetic surgery just a moment ago. So I think that's the problem. We can't just turn a switch and suddenly go to this universal healthcare system. The system couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
The minute there was a push on the system, where did they put us? They sent us to HEB, Walgreens, CVS. School auditoriums became inoculation centers. I mean, they immediately had, because the system cannot absorb all the people if they were to try and provide care to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
They simply couldn't. And so my point is, I think that a single-payer system is where it needs to go. It works elsewhere in the world very effectively, and I think they would have to phase it in. And I think they already have examples of models that they could work with. They could work with the Medicare population. They could work with the Medicaid population. Certainly, there's already the model within the military system where people are paid for, are provided care for within military, those that are active duty. So they're, all those people are employed by the military, paid by the military. So the government knows how to do it. It's just a matter of shifting from this, you know, system, which is so locked in thanks to lobbyists, you know, the insurance industry, the pharma industry, politicians, many of whom are retired medical professionals, you know, and so there's this whole system that doesn't want it to change and says it can't change. And so therefore, once again, oh, the doctor says it has to be this way, so it must be so. I'm saying it's time for the consumer to wake up and say, no, we deserve better and we demand better. And let's start getting it.
And we have 5 minutes for you to talk about what the consumer needs to do about his or her own health, which, about which I know you have a lot to say.
Well, you know, thanks. Again, this won't be a popular opinion, but the reality is I really feel that healthcare is in our hands. Each one of us is responsible for our own well-being, largely. And I think that, you know, once again, we've come to accept and believe the fact that, no, you need these things to be well. You need this, these medicines. You need this kind of regular care. You must, like I said, years ago when I had a physical to go to high school or when I was going to athletics, you know, I was stripped, I was searched top to bottom, I was tested, I was poked, I was prodded, I had pictures taken, all this stuff. Well, I just had my second Medicare, you know, physical, annual physical. I was fully clothed for the entire experience. No one touched me, only briefly, and it was all via a computer and asking me questions, which I answered. Which, and then, you know, they took all the labs, and so my numbers are good, so I'm fine for another year as far as they're concerned, unless something, you know, changes. Yeah. So again, I just feel like we're looking at a system that is not looking back at us in the same way that we're expecting it to. But more importantly, I think that we've come to accept or expect, as I said a second ago, that these guys are here to fix us. And I think much of what America is dealing with is self-inflicted. Diet, lifestyle is horrendous. The food industry in America is horrendous. And, you know, if you are living a healthy lifestyle in America, you are living an alternative lifestyle. And that anytime you're, you know, you're alternative to the herd, it's harder. And it
takes more expensive.
More expensive. It requires discipline. It requires, you know, more of an effort. Again, when I went to school, we had the president's physical fitness test. We had gym class every day. We were active. We had play, you know, the playground. We had recess. Just taking, you know, these basic needs out of day-to-day living are creating people that are really in bad health. I mean, you've seen, I don't know, maybe you haven't seen, but the numbers of young people being diagnosed with cancer in America, are, it's just, it's through the roof. And it's, you know, largely, they think, lifestyle, diet, induced. And again, I think that we have all bought into this mythology that, you know, America's the best place to live, the best lifestyle, the best health, all these things. And we're all consuming food that is, you know, manufactured and easy and fast and tasty. And it turns out it's not even food anymore. It's, I call it FOD. It's faux food. It's, you know, it's so processed. And I'm guilty of the same thing. I love it just as much as the next person, you know? And so, again, it's very difficult to make these changes because the system tells you at a certain age you should be doing this, and this is how you take care of yourself as you begin to age. And, you know, the reality is staying active, staying physical, staying certainly in terms of cognitive abilities. You know, we saw a lot about this in the last couple of weeks with, you know, with President Biden stepping down recently. You know, talking about cognitive decline, and people don't realize, you know, what's required to maintain cognitive wellness. It's not, you know, playing a game on the thing. It's actually new learning, testing, pushing yourself on a regular basis. And these are the kinds of things that aren't being talked about in the doctor's office, aren't being talked about anywhere, really. Instead, every time you turn on the TV, you're being bombarded with advertisements for another form of medicine. Right now, Ozempic is everyone's, you know, favorite thing. Everyone's losing weight on Ozempic. Well, there's going to be a side effect to Ozempic. If it hasn't, if it hasn't come out yet, it's going to come out. Right? And again, it's you're fooling the system. You're not really using your body to do what it can do, because you can get there on your own as well. Not easily, but it happens.
Well, I think those sort of were your final words, but are you? I think you ought to write another book sometime, maybe something else, because this was very informative, thought-provoking, and infinitely readable.
Thank you, Priscilla. Well, it's been a pleasure to be here and talk about it.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you so much for doing that. And no last words, or were those your last words?
I think that was a lot. I think I have more writing in me. I do enjoy it, and it was great to get it all out.
All right. Well, Clay DiStefano, thank you again for talking to me, and thank you for listening.
My pleasure.